United States versus O'Hara. Mr. Ackerman.
Splendid suit, Mr. Ackerman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And tie.
Wow. So please, the court. Ms. Johnson, along with Mark Martin, we represent Richard O'Hare. We advance a series of objections to the proceedings below, which we hope will culminate in conviction vacation. The Classified Information Procedure Act was invoked by the government at the end of the defense case. There were spirited arguments in chambers. The defendant was excluded. As a result of those proceedings, a mistrial was denied, a 30-day continuance was denied, a two-day continuance was granted, and ultimately the district court read a skeleton summary of that which a couple of witnesses would have testified to. The problems inherent with the district court's invocation of that process are almost mind-boggling. Nothing was said at the beginning of this case. The government indicated they had an open file policy, which meant in substance, according to the government now, that anything implicating the credibility of any prosecution witness would be made available in advance of trial. The grand jury testimony would be made available in advance of trial. And with that supposition, our discovery motions were rejected by the United States magistrate, and that's part of the appendix here where we set out that the magistrate relies on the government's representation. That said, we capitalized a theory of defense. A jury was impaneled. Opening statements went forward. The government presented their case. At the end of the government's case, there was a JOA granted as to one count. The defense then proceeded. And on a Monday in the afternoon, as I recall, we rested with our last witness. And I believe it's at TR 855, the government seeks to do something in chambers. We asked to be present, we're told we can't. Some time goes by, the judge summons us into chambers, and for the first time discloses that, lo and behold, there is something called the Classified Procedure Information Act.
By us, you mean you and the client, your client?
No, my client was always excluded. Pam Pepper was co-counsel.
Well, us just means the two attorneys are involved.
Yes, Your Honor.
Was the prosecution present, too?
Yes, Your Honor. And they had... Not only was Ms. Johnson, but Eric Klum. And they brought in a third prosecutor, Paul Kanter, K-A-N-T-E-R, who was represented to be the government CIPA specialist for the Milwaukee division of the U.S. Attorney's Office. Thereafter, the district court basically dismissed the defendants of the defense lawyers. And thereafter, there were a group of sessions, as near as we can understand it, that were tape recorded between government counsel, including trial counsel for the government, as I understand it, and the district court, which led to proceedings the next day, which would have been a Tuesday, as I recall. Or it may have been Tuesday, Wednesday. Please forgive me. The days fall into each other. But the next morning, we're back before the district court, and the district court again rejects any notion we're entitled to a mistrial. And theoretically tells us that, hey, you're right. There's stuff in here that you're entitled to. You should have had it. Sorry about that. Should have been turned over earlier, but the government acted in good faith, and that's just the way it is, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to deny your 30-day continuance request so you can find out what you can. I'm going to provide you with a summary. If you want the summary, you're not waiving anything by taking the summary. You can have Thursday and Friday off to try and do what you will. Well, there was one problem with that. Keep in mind the defendant has been excluded from these proceedings, number one. And I think Ms. Johnson will support the proposition that we understood that these were secret proceedings not to be shared with the accused. So it was not until The Thursday, keep in mind that this started Monday afternoon, on Thursday, during the first day of this two-day continuance, where the defendant and I were allowed to discuss what occurred. And that happened because I called Ms. Johnson's partner in the case, Mr. Plum, and he said, no problem, talk to your client about it. Fine. And that's the first we could disclose, as we understood it, to the client regarding everything that occurred. Question. Was it fair? Was the defendant deprived? The answer is yes. He was deprived of his opportunity to fully prepare and present his case. The government did an end run around reality here, and the reality was they should have made all this available. And on that subject, Mr. O'Hare, through counsel, would appreciate why the United States Attorney still hasn't made available an FBI file from Missouri and the grand jury testimony that led to the superseding indictment. It's still not disclosed. That said, I would get to the Travel Act. And
And I do have a question, Mr. Ackerman. What specifically, you got a summary of what the files were. I mean, obviously you couldn't test that because you couldn't look at the files, but we assume that the district court accurately summarized what was in the report. What prejudice did you suffer by not getting the actual report?
Your Honor, we suffered the prejudice of not having the opportunity to have this in advance of trial so we can set the contours of our case. Please keep in mind
can
that
you
the
be more concrete?
Yeah, in terms of how you could use it. How
we could use
the information.
It.
Yeah, I'm trying to get something more specific.
Well, for example, we learned, I believe, that there were three witnesses who would have undermined the credibility of the primary prosecution witness, Mr. El-Shafiq. His brother, we had no idea about that, who called him basically a liar, a woman in the community, his ex-wife, and we knew about his ex-wife only because the day before trial, as the record shows here and it's part of our appendix, we got a two-page fax where she wrote to the FBI about the primary prosecution witness. So the contours of our defense vis-a-vis this witness were undermined by virtue of the lack of information.
And so once you got this information and you knew about these witnesses, did you ask the district court? I mean, I assume because the district court gave you a recess, you could have reopened your case. Did you ever propose that?
The district court allowed the defense to re-rest after he read this short summary to the jury.
Yeah, but
he would not enlarge our time more than the 2 days prior to the weekend to see what we could do with even the limited information he provided. Now, please, I'm sorry.
But so did you ask to call any of these witnesses?
We did not. We did not. Judge Posner, I'm sorry you were going to ask.
No, I just had a similar question. Yeah, what concretely you thought the prejudice was?
It was significant. In light of the fact the red light is on, my Travel Act argument speaks for itself, and Mr. Martin will present the sentencing argument on behalf of Mr. O'Hare. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ackerman. Mr. Martin?
Good morning, Your Honors. As Mr. Ackerman said, I'm here to talk about the sentence. I have really one argument, and it's a simple one. And the argument is that the guideline section 5G1.2D, which seemingly mandates a consecutive sentence in these type of circumstances that confronted a district court, conflicts with the statute being 18 U.S.C. 3584, sections A and B. If you look at the plain language of the statute, not the guideline, it almost suggests as if there's a presumption that the sentences should be concurrent. The language says that when multiple terms of imprisonment are imposed at the same time, the sentence should be concurrently unless the court orders otherwise or a statute otherwise requires.
So you're challenging the validity of the guideline, is that it?
I'm not challenging the validity of the guideline itself. I am saying that the guideline conflicts with the statute.
Well, if it conflicts with the statute, isn't it invalid? I don't understand.
It was validly enacted, I suppose, but...
Well, I don't understand you.
When you have a conflict between a statute and a guideline, the statute has to control.
So you're saying the guideline is invalid because it's inconsistent with the statute.
On further reflection, I guess that's a way of looking at it.
The only way to look at it to me, maybe I'm missing something.
I think it's just a matter of...
Just pile right in and beat it up. Say it's invalid and let it go with that.
Okay, you have to...
You're not getting a fan of the guidelines with me, at least, so, you know, carry on.
The statute has to control in these circumstances. And you look at 3584B, it says you determine whether a sentence is concurrent or consecutive by applying the factors in 3553A. And that lists about 7 factors for the court to apply in making a determination whether a sentence should be concurrent or consecutive. Now, you have to analyze that against what happened in this case. Mr. Ackerman brought up at sentencing that, Your Honor, you have the discretion to impose a concurrent sentence here. And the district court initially said that I don't believe I do, turned to the probation officer for guidance. She, of course, cited 5G1.2D, and at that point, the matter was basically resolved with the district court believing it did not have discretion. Later on in the sentencing, the defense made motions for downward departure based on various factors, including the fact that the co-defendant received an 8-month sentence, health considerations, things of that nature. And after the district court denied that motion, Mr. Ackerman further suggested, Your Honor, in spite of 5G1.2D, you can depart downward. And the district court responded with, well, under Kuhn, I always have the discretion to depart. But the court didn't apply the factors in 3553A, which the statute says the court is supposed to do. There's nothing in this record in which the court went through those factors and said in determining whether the sentence should be concurrent, in determining whether it should be consecutive, A applies, B doesn't apply, the whole list of factors. That didn't occur here. So we have a sentence which was imposed without reference to the correct standard under the statute. And the statute is what controls, and I think just getting back to Judge Posner's question, I think it's just a matter of semantics where I'm saying it's inconsistent and Your Honor's saying it's invalidly enacted. In its brief, the government cites United States versus Schaefer. Now, Schaefer didn't consider the very same guideline at that issue here. It considered a different consecutive sentencing guideline. But in that case, the court talked about the conflict between the statute and the guideline. The court stated that the statute controls, and it stated that there was a circuit split on how to handle this. Some circuits had said, you just apply the statute without reference to the guideline. And, of course, that's the approach that we're suggesting. And then the second line position was that you have to apply downward departure considerations, and that's how you resolve this inconsistency, which is there. And that is the approach that Schaefer took, although, as I said, it doesn't involve this very same guideline. And in this case, the district court, while it recognized it had the departure authority, it didn't look at that with reference to 3553A. And what Schaefer says is you have to look at 3553A and apply those circumstances. And that didn't occur here. So even if you take our first argument, which is the statute controls, there's no compliance with 3553A, and even if you take our second argument, which is a downward departure is the way you resolve the conflict, there was no reference in making that determination to the 3553A factors. So again, either way you look at it, you have a sentence here which was imposed without reference to the correct standard. The government has not shown that the sentence would be the same. Mr. O'Hara received a substantial sentence here, the maximum he could possibly be given, and we'd ask that the case be remanded for a resentencing.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Martin. Ms. Johnson?
May it please the court, my name is Tracy Johnson. I represent the appellee in this matter, and I was trial counsel at the district court level. First, I would like to go through a set of the facts so there is a clear understanding of the series of events.
We read all the facts. What I'm curious about is when did you first discover that there was some material that could not be made available to the defendant?
We first discovered the evening after Mr. Ackerman, I believe it was on the 13th, after he suggested that there may have very well been some additional information. We proceeded into chambers.
Wait. He figured out that there was something else he didn't have, or how?
Yes.
My question is, when did you find out, you, the government, find out, your branch of the government, find out that some other person in government had a file on one of the government witnesses?
The U.S. Attorney's Office discovered either the night of March 12th, after the conversations with Attorney Ackerman, that he had spoken with the ex-wife, and she mentioned that there may be additional information on him.
Mr. Ackerman told the U.S. Attorney that the ex-wife had told him that she had sent a letter to the FBI.
No, that she had mentioned, we provided the letter, the government provided the FBI letter to Mr. Ackerman on the 7th. The 7th is when the U.S. attorneys received it from the FBI in Missouri.
Is that during the trial?
The trial actually started on the 8th, so the day before the trial. The day before the trial.
Your open file policy doesn't mean a lot if you don't have anything in the file. Essential information is not in the file.
It's true that we did rely upon our open file policy.
Yeah.
It is also true.
And that's why there was no further discovery.
That is correct. Typically, we do not assume, as we acknowledge at the district court level, that the majority of witnesses have a counterintelligence file.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't either, but was there any inquiry at all as to this, or was there any knowledge on your part that there was some suspicion that these guys might be involved in something funny?
No,
it's kind of a crazy, odd case. You have to admit that. It's one you might look into.
It is somewhat of a strange case, and even on additional reflection and review of the letter, which we received on March 7th, there are a number of things that are in the letter. Gaddafi is not mentioned in the letter. What is mentioned in the letter is, one, the poor relationship that the individual had, that the ex-wife had with her husband. There's also mentioned, which is something that we did inquire about questioning El Shafei's relationship with the local FBI, because there was an accusation that he was receiving favors from the local FBI. And that is what stood out, and that is what the government made, which I personally made inquiries about to the FBI.
And the Bureau said no?
And they said no, that they were aware that he was facing charges and that they had not interfered in those charges. And I believe, consequently, he did end up with convictions related to the incidents that were ongoing during the trial.
What incident?
He had had an altercation with someone which resulted in a state-level prosecution. Once the government became aware of the information, we provided it to the district court for...
You mean you went back in the back room with the district court and told him about it?
Well, Your Honor, I did not go in the back room because I do not have clearance. I did not have the...
They wouldn't even let you know about it?
That's correct. I have never seen the file. So I could not possibly comment as to what is in the file.
They give you a witness, or I let you use a witness that they're working with on a secret case they won't even tell you about?
That is correct. That is why...
Did they get around to telling the judge, or did they require that he go through the Q clearance?
No, they met with the district court. Two of the U.S. attorney, assistant U.S. attorneys met with the district court. They had
Q clearance.
Yes, they had clearance. For those of us who did not have clearance, we were not part of the ex parte.
So you can't really tell us what happened there?
No, I cannot. I was not privy to it. I have never listened to the tape. I have never examined the file. So I cannot tell you what was in the file. My representations to the court today are based on the information that we received in chambers.
From an open file they gave you, yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
But based on that information that was provided, the issue of whether or not there was prejudice is clear. There was not prejudice due to the fact that even the information that was provided was never utilized by...
Well, that's assuming that there's nothing else in the information that might be helpful to Mr. Ackerman's client.
No.
That decision was made by the judge, if I recall correctly.
There was a decision made by the judge about there were 10 statements, at least 10 statements that he felt were in the file that should be reviewed. All those statements were reviewed among among both the prosecutors and defense counsel, and later permission was granted so that Mr. Ackerman could discuss those things with his client. As appears in the appellant's appendix, those statements were read, but he was given an opportunity to contact three individuals because their names were declassified by the FBI. And once those names were declassified, the names were actually declassified, I believe, on the 14th. He was given until the 19th to call witnesses. However, defense counsel contacted the government on the 15th, and it is also in the trial court record that they elected not to call any of the witnesses whose names were provided to them. So even with the information that was provided to them, it was not utilized.
And I assume those tapes are up here.
Yes, those tapes are with you. And I believe that the earlier submissions that were made to the court, they remain sealed, and that we had briefed that previously. Now, with respect to the challenge to the sentencing guidelines, the government remained that it is valid. When we look at Schaefer, although it is not the exact same guideline, it maintains that the way to resolve the conflict between the sentence under the United States Sentencing Guidelines and 3584 is to allow the court to maintain discretion to depart downward. As opposing counsel mentioned, the court was well aware that it had such discretion. It opted not to utilize such discretion, and therefore, there is no problem with the fact that the defendant had a guideline range of 151 to 188 months, that he had a maximum of 60 months on each count, and that he received a 120-month sentence.
Let me just get back to the Brady issue. Now is there any kind of sweep that's done of FBI files for Brady material in light of this situation? I mean, is there a reason that it shouldn't just be routinely done? I mean, most of the times it would end up probably not being a hit.
Well, Your Honor, I cannot speak to and do not know if there has been an overall change in policy, so I cannot provide.
You're not privy to any of this information, I take it. I think you ought to get Q clearance just to make an application to get it, at least.
But I'm sure in light of recent events that this is something that will probably be taken under great consideration. And I admittedly have learned my own lesson from these series of events.
Just as a detail, these astrolabes, are they really valuable?
Actually, yes, they are. They were not worth the $5 million that Mr. O'Hara thought that they were worth, but they did turn out to be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. They were not worth millions of dollars.
Have they all been recovered?
All the ones that were in their possession, which were in Carol's and O'Hara's possession.
Are they being given back to Rome? Or
they were supposed to have gone back to Rome quite some time ago, but I was recently informed by the FBI agent that they are still in the FBI's possession, but I'm sure the planetarium. There was a court order. They were supposed to be returned to Rome.
They don't feel compelled to comply with the court order, I take it.
I don't know if it's that or just a lack of travel.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Johnson. And Mr. Ackerman, does he have any time? 1 minute?
Well, if we're given 10 individuals that provided information to the government and three are disclosed, what happened to the other seven? Is that to remain secret in the government archives forever? Is Mr. O'Hare, and that's the focus here, he's doing 10 years for trying to get back from a thief, to return to a thief.
So what do you want us to do? You want us to listen to the...
I'd like to listen to him. I have a motion pending for disclosure. And if a protective order is in order, that's fine. I won't disclose it, but I should have the right to have the opportunity to listen. And that's one of the things that's pending before the court. Thank you for your time.
Okay, well, thank you to both sides. The case will be taken under advisement, and court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow.